From our studios in downtown Portland, Oregon, this is a Coin6 Digital exclusive.
Columbus Day storm in October of 1962 is a piece of Pacific Northwest history.
There are a row of trees just uprooted and just landed on their house.
It's ranked as one of the strongest and most deadly windstorms to strike the region, killing dozens and injuring hundreds.
This is so devastating that I don't really have the words to describe it.
Weather events as large as the Columbus Day storm don't happen often. But what are the odds that we see another large-scale windstorm strike the region this winter? Or next. John Dodge, a veteran journalist from Olympia, Washington, spent decades of his career investigating natural disasters around the Pacific Northwest. John recently published his book, A Deadly Wind, that dives deep into the center of the Columbus Day storm and what caused it to become the powerhouse that it did. Here's our conversation on the Columbus Day storm and on the impacts and odds of another windstorm occurring in the near future.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. Oh, geez, sorry. We're checking mic levels. Sorry about that. Can you do a mic check, please, John, and say mic check 1, 2, 3?
Mic check 1, 2, 3.
Okay. All right, here we go. John, thanks for joining us. Can you tell me a little bit about your career as a columnist, you know, a writer and a reporter? And I have read that you've got decades of experience here.
Well, that's true. That's what happens when you pile up the years. I'm a 40-year veteran of print journalism, much of it spent at the Olympian in Olympia, Washington. I was initially an environmental natural resource reporter through the 80s and 90s, and then segued into a three times a week column. And then joined the editorial page and was an editorial page writer for some of that time I was a columnist. So had just about every job in the writing job in the newsroom.
Yeah, 4 decades. I'm just entering my 5th year here in broadcast. So quite a bit of experience comparably to mine.
I'm glad we're still attracting young, bright minds to the field of journalism.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Meteorology.
Yes, very true. What's cool about your career is you reported a lot on natural disasters, too. I saw that you reported on the Mount St. Helens eruption back in the 80s and also a lot of Pacific Northwest earthquakes.
Correct. It seemed like just about any time a big weather or natural disaster event occurred, I took on the role as the lead reporter and helped kind of organize coverage and wrote the main bars and immersed myself in the event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is awesome. We've had quite a few pretty large events here. The one that I wanted to focus on and what your expertise has been in, and you just released a book on this last year, is the Columbus Day storm. So we are coming up on the anniversary. It happened on October 12th in 1962. So you were alive through this, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I was a 14-year-old teenager here in the Olympia area. And experienced it firsthand, was sequestered in a house with my family and another family riding out the storm, and had a pretty good sized Douglas fir tree crash down on the house and scared the dickens out of all of us. And it was one of those memorable moments in your life that you never forget. It was akin to something like the 1963 assassination of John F. Kennedy, or the John Glenn orbiting the Earth for the first time. All those sort of national historic moments kind of came home to roost in the Northwest that day.
Right. And the damage done wasn't just at the coast. It also came into the valley, too, and through Portland, right?
Oh, boy, did it. It was Willamette Valley was ground zero for the storm. What you had was a massive windstorm, mid-latitude cyclone that marched up the West Coast from Northern California to the for 24 hours before it finally died in northeast Vancouver Island in British Columbia. So you had major hurricane-like winds in many places for lasting for up 2 to 3 hours at a time as the storm moved almost on a direct south to north trajectory along the coast. So the coast was battered, but the winds also funneled up through the Willamette Valley and Puget Sound.
Right. So Oregon was, again, ground zero, but did areas of Washington, maybe even Idaho and further east, did they see any effects from the storm too?
Well, there were reports of strong winds, not as strong as on the west side of the Cascades, but the Bend, Sisters, Redmond area, it was a noticeable stormy night. But primarily, the windstorm is considered a western Oregon, western Washington phenomenon. The Cascade Mountains form a pretty considerable barrier when you have a wind coming almost directly from the south. And the pressure gradients for the storm were aligned in an east-west pattern, so west-east pattern. So the winds tended to funnel right up the valley, much like a Venturi effect.
That is just incredible. I can't even imagine seeing that, you know, happen in our area again. Can you kind of dive more into the details of the size and strength of the storm? Like, how strong were some of those wind reports that we've received in the valley and out towards the coast?
Sure. There was some incredible winds recorded. If you start down at Cape Blanco, the headland in southern Oregon, there was a Coast Guard station there that they had an official reading of 139 miles an hour, but then the anemometers, the wind gauges, blew away, and they were kind of guesstimating what the actual peak gusts were, but the folks at the station were pretty confident it was over 170 miles an hour. Similar thing happened. You had winds of 100 and just a second, I'm going to double check a couple numbers here. But as you move north up the coast, you look at Newport, 138 miles an hour. They abandoned the Coast Guard station there. A little bit to the east in Corvallis, 127 miles an hour. The weather observer at the Weather Bureau station at the airport abandoned his station. So there were weather observers and military personnel at installations along the coast that were abandoning their posts just for fear of their lives.
Oh, my gosh.
You get up to Portland, you see 116 miles an hour along on the Morrison Avenue Bridge. The winds were over 160 miles an hour in southwest Washington at another Air Force station. And even though it's starting to dissipate somewhat, you still see nearly 100 mile an hour winds in Bellingham up in near the Canadian border in Washington and 90 miles an hour in Vancouver, BC. So it packed a punch.
Yeah. Very, very much widespread across the entire Pacific Northwest. So what about rain? Was that an issue too? Was there much flash flooding with this storm?
No, it's interesting. This was almost exclusively a windstorm, but as it moved from its breeding grounds off the North California coast. The rain, and you could probably explain this better than I as a meteorologist, but the rain seemed to stall out. And in the tail of the storm over the Bay Area, the Oakland, San Francisco area, where they had record-setting rain for Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the storm hit. Bear in mind, the main storm struck on Friday. But they had record types of rainfall, deadly mudslides and landslides and flooding up here as the winds were the story. We had very little rainfall at all.
We must have, just lost the moisture down south and carried the energy up the coast.
So it's a lot different than a hurricane, although they're, you know, it is a form of a cyclone, these mid-latitude, these mid-latitude cyclones that are born out of pressure, air pressure differences and temperature differences.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about the origins of the storm? So I did read that the start of the storm was actually a typhoon, Typhoon Frida, which just tracked across the Pacific Ocean basin.
Correct. So what we had a typhoon form in the Marshall Islands in the far reaches of the Western Pacific on October 3rd of 1962. And it took a fairly a fairly defined path across the Pacific Ocean and maintained typhoon force, which is 74 miles an hour or more, just like a hurricane, force winds all the way until the 10th of October. By then, it's well on its way to the West Coast, and it maintained enough of a storm formation, enough strength to, it was kind of parked off of the North California coast west of Fort Bragg, California, on the night of the 11th. And then it was re-energized with a warm front from the tropics from the south and a cold air mass from the Aleutian Islands from the Gulf of Alaska to the north. And it, you know, it re-energized and became a meteorological bomb. You know, the barometric pressure dropped 2/3 of an inch in 6 hours. And ships at sea were reporting being pummeled by heavy winds and rain off the coast. And by Friday morning, it was clear that we were in for a really rough day in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I did see some photos of the track, and the typhoon again moved from the west to the east across the Pacific. And it seemed like it picked up its energy when it hit the 140 degree longitudinal line, and then it just went straight north from there.
Yeah, the trajectory is interesting because, as you well know, we do experience mid-latitude cyclones, extratropical cyclones, on a fair regularity every 10 to 20 years or so in the Northwest. But this one had several features that made it exceptional, including how close the storm center was to the coastline. It was the closest of all the big storms of the last 100 years, and it usually you have your strongest winds in the southeast quadrant of these rotating storms, and that placed the strongest winds right over the population centers of the Willamette Valley and Puget Sound.
Yeah.
And you also had pretty much a north to south straight line trajectory, whereas a lot of times these storms will come in more on a west to east flow pattern, which, you know, they may strike a region in the Northwest, but then they'll blow into the Cascade Mountains and dissipate. Whereas this one, you know, raced right up the West Coast.
Right. I've worked with the National Weather Service here in Portland a couple times, and they've always mentioned that the thing to watch, especially this time of the year into wintertime, is large systems that maybe just travel straight north in between the 140 degree to 130 degree longitudinal line. So that's just, you know, the landing zone, the landing strip for these storms to just gain so much power and then bring some deadly winds into our region.
Exactly. You might recall it was just 3 years ago, almost to the week, that we all went on a high alert here in the Northwest, fearing for there was a typhoon Songda in the Western Pacific that had many of the characteristics of Frida, and there was fear that it was going to re-energize and strike with much the same power as Columbus Day Storm. Luckily, fortunately for all of us, it did not pan out to be as bad as it was forecast to be, but I know a lot of stores were people flocked to the stores for provisions. There was a lot of concern that it could become one of those storms for the ages.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, I was stationed in the Tri-Cities, Washington, that's Southeast Washington, working for a news station there as their meteorologist. And I remember that coming in, and I think there was a lot of flack for all the meteorologists who, well, the forecast busted. That's a lot of people said with this this particular system, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, there was some, the postmortem on the weather forecasting that occurred was interesting to read and watch. It was a kind of one of those cautionary tales, I think, about be sure to explain the
the uncertainty,
predictability.
Yeah.
What are the odds of this happening? Was there a 1 in 5 chance, a 1 in 3 chance type situation? You guys are always fine tuning your the way you do forecasts, and this
yep.
was another good critique, I think.
Yeah, it's the hardest part of the job. Okay, so are there any comparable storms that we've seen in recent decades? Like, what were some of the other events that brought some damaging winds to this region?
Well, yes, there are several. We've had several major extratropical cyclones in the last 50 years. One that comes to mind most recently was in 2006. That storm, I have to kind of do a little quick memory search here in terms of just how bad it was, but it was a 2-day storm. It became known as the Hanukkah Eve storm of December 14th and 15th, and it had winds gusting from 70 miles to 90 miles per hour through much of western Washington. It lashed the Oregon coast as well with hurricane force winds. There was multiple fatalities and widespread power outages. And then you have a similar storm in 1993, right around the Clinton inauguration. So it became known as the inaugural day storm. Another one in 1981. These are all significant, especially if you were directly in the storm path. But invariably, none of them had the swath of destruction, the total reach of Columbus Day storm.
Yeah, so that still goes down as the largest storm that we've seen in this area. Is that right?
Yeah, I start off my speech by my talks and my presentation calling it the strongest windstorm in West Coast recorded history. And I just can't find anything in the written record that holds a candle to this one.
It's time to take a break. We'll be right back.
Did you know podcasts are reaching more than half of the households in America? Thousands of people are downloading shows from the COIN Podcast Network.
Now you can walk anywhere in Portland and know that must be Darcel.
And that number is growing every single day. That means if you advertise with us, your message would be heard time and time again by hundreds of potential customers.
I made like 500 bumper stickers that said Keep Portland Weird.
Right now, the COIN Podcast Network features podcasts on the Oregon Ducks,
Scott Reed, senior writer for Ducks Sports Authority,
the Oregon State Beavers.
I think Oregon State's going to score points. I don't think that's going to be a problem for us.
Up-and-coming authors from our area.
Is Writer's Block Podcast.
True Crime.
Collapsed and died before getting anyone's attention.
And the important role weather plays in all of our lives.
Fires that get large, 3/4 of those come from lightning.
As you are listening to this, more unique content is under development. So, if you're looking to reach a new audience and want to know what sponsorship and advertising opportunities are available, email us at coinpodcasts@coin.com.
And welcome back. We'll jump back into my interview with John Dodge about the Columbus Day windstorm. Can you discuss, maybe moving forward, so how maybe climate change may impact our windstorm season, or how any weather shifts that we've seen maybe in the jet stream, or how El Nino could impact these coming winters?
Well, you know, this is, Kelly, you probably know more about this than I, but it's an interesting topic. And, you know, for an author writing a book about a killer windstorm in the era of climate change, you know, it would have been a real helpful marketing tool to say, and guess what, folks, this is exactly what we're going to see more of, and more intense and more frequent in the years ahead in the Northwest. Well, the climate modeling doesn't suggest that to date. I think there's some understandable reasons that in the Pacific Northwest, as you mentioned, the jet stream, I think we're seeing a slow, steady shift to the north, and that, you know, the jet stream being a main transport vehicle for these mighty windstorms. I think the modeling shows that we should see maybe more activity in the Washington, British Columbia area, a little less in Oregon as the jet stream shifts northwards. But probably the most significant reason that no one's sounding the alarm as of yet is that the Arctic region is warming so much more rapidly than the mid-latitude regions. This reduces that extreme pressure difference in temperatures that fuel these cyclones in the North Pacific in the mid-latitude region. So that has a dampening or tamping effect, I think, on the likelihood of even stronger storms in the future.
The severity.
Now, this is a different story on the East Coast. I mean, I think the hurricane seasons are getting longer and more severe. And I think we need to look at the difference between the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. You know, the Atlantic Ocean is just a pond, quote unquote, compared to the Pacific, which covers a third of the Earth's surface. And, you know, there's just a lot of time out. There's a lot of opportunity out there in the Pacific for these storms to dissipate and slow down or fall apart as they move into the colder water. I think everybody agrees we're going to see more rain and we're going to see sea level rise. We'll have a lot of disruptive weather patterns, but I've yet to see anyone predict that the Columbus Day storm is going to become a Columbus Day storm. Severity of that storm is likely to become commonplace in the years ahead. Mm-hmm. Now, that could all change. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a very interesting topic, and there are a lot of minds thinking about this. And so I guess your main points are that the jet stream is shifting more north. So the climate models really aren't pointing to any increase in activity. But have you noticed any maybe decadal patterns or 10-year, 5-year patterns for getting windstorms forming, at least in the forecast? Have you noticed any patterns?
Personally, I haven't. I haven't looked at it quite like that. I just noticed the pattern seems to be that we see these destructive, lethal windstorms on a 10 to 20 year cycle, and they kind of pattern or parallel the frequency of the larger earthquakes in the region. Although I know there's no actual connection between the two, but the timing of them in terms of how often we see them is pretty similar. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like we're due. We are due, it seems, for another major windstorm. And, of course, we're just now entering this windy, stormy season. So I guess this is when all our antenna goes up.
Right. So, I mean, you just retired. Do you think if we get a big windstorm, you'll get right back to the books and try and cover it?
Well, I don't know if I would cover it per se, but I would imagine if we had a Columbus Day type storm that knocked this one out of the record books, I'd probably get a few phone calls for comments.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be one of them.
I was actually kind of watching that closely with interest in 2016 because I was in the final stages of completing the manuscript. And as Typhoon Songda was marching across the ocean, and people were calling and emailing saying, John, what's this going to do to your book if this storm strikes? I said, well, you know, it could diminish the import of the book, but it, what's more important is the, you know, the tragedies that could occur if it happened in today's built environment.
Yeah.
A region with a population three times as great as what we had in 62.
Yeah. Can you go into some of maybe the major impacts that we would see in this day and age if we got a storm that large, like the Columbus Day storm?
Yeah. Well, I just kind of touched on a couple, but the fact is that it's kind of a good news, bad news story. The good news is the advances in weather forecasting are exponential since 62. You know, it was more an art than a science then. It was the dawn of the computer age, but it was not a time of high resolution predictions and tools out there to track what's happening in the ocean. So, you know, your colleagues were flying in the dark, so to speak, when this storm was advancing. They, you know, no satellites orbiting the Earth with comprehensive images of storm patterns. So anyway, I digress a bit here, but to get back to your specific question, we would have 3 to 5 days advance warning, right?
Yeah, so just much more notice.
I think that's pretty safe to say.
Yeah.
Whereas in this case, we had hours.
Yeah.
Maybe. So we would have more time to get ready for whatever's coming. However, there's way more of us than there were in 62. You know, I think roughly we've tripled the region's population. You know, and then you think of the built environment today versus 1962. Immense amount of structures and infrastructure and buildings, commercial, residential, that would be in harm's way. So some of the estimates are that we would see tens of billions of dollars of damage if the same storm struck today. We may be hunkered down and we may be ready for it, but that doesn't stop it from doing the damage it would do.
Right.
And then I think our communication systems would be not just challenged, but crippled by the storm. You know, the way we rely now more on cell phones and computers, I think, you know, we would have, you know, an amazing amount of blackout, you know.
Yeah.
Unable to contact each other.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Oh, boy. Well, I mean, we are entering the windstorm season, so let's cross our fingers for a storm that's not the size of the Columbus Day storm. But we'll see what happens going into winter.
Yeah, well, it's always an interesting time of the year. And I haven't seen anything in the long range projections or even, you know, you see anything out there that's coming our way?
Yeah, not at the time being. So hope to keep it that way. Yeah, well, I think that is, those are all the questions I've got for you. Is there anything else that you want to add?
Well, there's just kind of a interesting thing I've noticed by this book. You know, this storm struck during the Cold War, and 10 days after the storm had moved through the region, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so then all of a sudden we're into this horrific fear of nuclear holocaust. So this story, this storm and better explanation of it were kind of disregarded and swept off the front page due to a more, you know, a global catastrophe in the making. So I think a lot of people were left with a lot of unanswered questions about what happened, what just happened to our region. And so I found as I go out and talk about the storm and share my stories, I receive a lot of stories back from storm survivors, and they also seem to appreciate the fact that they have some closure now on just what the heck happened.
Well, John, thanks for joining me on this podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today and share what you know on windstorms.
Well, while we were talking, my new new puppy chewed a big hole in one of my dining room chairs. So
oh, no.
You just never know what's going to happen with these young dogs.
Yeah. Aw. Poor little guy. Poor you.
He's bored. I guess. All right.
All right.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, John, thank you. I really appreciate it.
John's book, A Deadly Wind, released back in October of 2018. You can find his book at several local bookstores like Powell's and Broadway Books.
The Coin6 Podcast Network is your home for all sorts of content you can't find anywhere else. Visit coin.com/coinpodcast to see our entire library. And you can always subscribe to all of the Coin6 Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.